Good morning. Good to be here again today. I have been asked to speak this morning and then tonight on the topic, How the Reformation Came to England. During the worship, we'll be preaching from Luke's Gospel, chapter 17. The story is a fascinating story. It reminds me of the words of the prophet Habakkuk in chapter 1, verse 5. He says, "Look among the nations and watch, be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe though I told you." Now, the application of that is very different, of course, but still, it is astounding to think about the way that God worked in the 16th century to begin the process of Reformation, because really, our history depends on the things that happened back then. We are the heirs of these strange things. One of our 17th century Baptist fathers, his name was Edward Terrell, he actually kept a record of the minutes of the meetings of his church. It was the Broadmead Bristol Church out in the West Country of England. And in those minutes, he gives a 12-step story of how his church came into existence. And he begins with the Reformation on the continent with Luther and Calvin. Then he comes over across the channel to England, and he talks about the Reformation under Henry VIII. And he uses a really interesting phrase to describe Henry VIII and those who worked with him when God used them to bring the Reformation to England. He calls them rough and rough. Now, you can't tell that there are two different spellings in those words. The first one is R-U-F-F, and the second one is R-O-U-G-H. And I'm sure he used the two of them, which are, they're homophones. They sound the same, though they're spelled differently. I'm sure he used those for effect. But what he meant by them, the first rough, R-U-F-F, you know, it's like a ruffle, right? Something that you add to clothing to make it look more beautiful, but also sometimes people who wear ruffles, especially the big ones, they're trying to draw attention to themselves. When he uses the word rough, he means vainglorious. And the second time that he uses the word rough, he means arrogant. So he's looking back at King Henry VIII, and he says that his actions were vainglorious. They were an attempt to bring glory to himself, but they were also arrogant because they ran roughshod over others. Someone asked me the other day, have I watched the recent episodes of Wolf Hall on PBS, which is telling the story of Henry VIII through the eyes of Thomas Cromwell? And I said, yes. And I said, one of the things that you learned from watching Wolf Hall is you didn't want to be close to Henry VIII because you probably might not survive as a result of that. So you can watch that and you can see. I've seen two of the three of them. Now, let me give you what I might call some pre-applications to this material. Okay, usually you save the applications for the end. I'm going to put them at the beginning and suggest five things to you. Why it's important to think about these things. Why should we take the time on a day like today and think about them? Five reasons. Number one, this really does help us to understand our own roots. Our confession of faith and our Puritan era Baptist fathers were all shaped by the events of the century or so that preceded them. And it helps us to understand a very important context to the theology and the practice of our confession of faith. It really does. Secondly, when we talk about the Reformation under Henry VIII, and as it proceeds later on under Edward and then under Elizabeth, which we won't have the time to talk about, all of these things help us to understand the nature of English Puritanism. Now, I said yesterday, I think it was, that English Puritanism is just the British version of the Reformed faith on the continent of Europe. But that's not to deny that there aren't some interesting, unusual practices and doctrines that develop in England that maybe aren't so well known on the continent. One of them is the importance of preaching. You know, the preachers, the Puritan preachers in England were called Stupor Mundi, the wonder of the world. England had more fine preachers, it was recognized, than any other country at that time. And our emphasis on preaching comes through the English Reformation as opposed to the Continental Reformation. That's not to say that Calvin wasn't a great preacher. But many of the other Reformed men on the continent were not known to be the kind of preachers that Calvin was. But you come to the English Puritans and you have preaching everywhere and very fine preachers. And most of the Puritan books that we read these days are just records of their sermons that were written down and kept for us. That's the blessing and benefit that we have. Listen to John Owen in a comment that he made. "And as for those of latter days, though the names of the principal and most eminent of them, as Bucer, Martin Bucer, John Calvin, Peter Martyr Vermili, Theodore Beza, are now condemned and despised by many, mostly by those who never once seriously attempted the exposition of any one chapter in the whole Scripture, yet those who firmly design to grow in the knowledge of God and of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ both do and always will bless God for the assistance He gave them in their great and holy works and in the benefit which they receive by their labors." Let's just think of this in another way. Our confession is an English Puritan document. And our roots are here in the English Reformation and in the Puritanism that develops out of the English Reformation. Third pre-application is this. These strange events that we'll describe cause us to reflect on the purposes and actions of God. There are many deep mysteries involved in the Reformation. For example, you know, when they looked back on the Middle Ages, many of the reformers called that era a variation of the phrase anti-Christian darkness, the Dark Ages. Why did God allow the Dark Ages in the first place? Why did the church fall prey to what it became in the Middle Ages? Why was a return to biblical Christianity so agonizingly difficult? Because it really was. You know, we tell the story sometimes triumphantly, but it was actually very, very difficult. I'm sure you know in Martin Luther's life how he was in danger all the time of death. He thought at any moment someone would come and kill him. And he had to be protected by Frederick the Wise. We could ask the question, why did the Lord use such strange instruments? And Henry VIII, so far as we can tell, was never a believer. But God used him to bring the Reformation to England. Why? Why? So those are interesting questions to reflect on. The fourth of these pre-applications, to think about the Reformation teaches us patience and perseverance. You know, the process of Reformation was very slow, and it faced many hindrances. In fact, we might even ask the question, has it ever been finished? Did the Reformation ever really come to a full and final conclusion? Well, you know, we live in a day and age of instant gratification, of fast things, but we need to realize that God's time is not our time. And in many cases, it is important for us to slow down and take the long view rather than the short view. That's now that I've reached this age of my life, that's what I'm realizing about my own life, is I hope that I'm planting some seeds that I probably will not see come to fruition, but hopefully in 30 years or 50 years, we'll see some things, or those who are younger than us will see things that we don't see today. That's my hope. And then the fifth pre-application to all of this is it reminds us to trust in the sovereign purpose of God, because God always accomplishes His purposes, always. And He is able to bring much good out of dark and seemingly hopeless situations. At the end of the prophecy of Habakkuk, the prophet has struggled with the fact that God did not bring judgment upon the nation of Israel, and when the Lord says He's bringing the Babylonians against them, the prophet goes into a deeper funk. Why would God use the Babylonians? They're worse than the Israelites. And he wrestles with that. But at the end of his prophecy, he comes to the conclusion that God is free to do as he pleases. And his responsibility is to bow down before the Lord. And brothers and sisters, that's what we are called to do as well, to bow down before him. He will accomplish all of his sovereign purposes. There's nothing that happens on this earth that can frustrate the plan and the purpose of God. And that's a great comfort for us. All right, now, the next thing that we need to do is ask the question, what is or what was the Reformation? Let's try to define this a little bit. Let me put the question another way. How much is necessary doctrinally, practically, to consider a church in a time or a place to be reformational? All right, how much is necessary? Well, a simple answer to that question is we might say that the Reformation was a recovery of the gospel in its purity. A recovery of the gospel in its purity. And that's the simplest definition that we can offer because it applies to a wide variety of church groups. You know, you look back at the 16th century at the Reformation, and first you have the Lutheran Reformation. Then in Zurich, you have the Zwinglian Reformation. And in Geneva, you have the Calvinist Reformation. And around the same time, you have the beginnings of the English Reformation. And they all go in slightly different directions. The Lutherans were not the Zwinglians, and the Zwinglians eventually did merge largely with the Calvinists to become the Swiss Reform. But the English also moved in a different direction. You have a Lutheran kind of church, and you have a Reformed kind of church, and then you have the Episcopalian Church of England, and they're different. But they all shared one thing in common, and that was a recovery of the gospel in its purity. A proclamation that salvation comes by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. And they all believed that very much. Now, having said that, having defined the Reformation very simply, that begs the next question, is that all? What about worship? What about church government? You know, the Roman Catholic response to the Reformation was finalized in a very important meeting called the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent rejected the doctrine of the Reformation. And the Council of Trent is one of those moments, because we live after it, it's difficult for us to understand what was happening before it. You know, we know the end of the story. We know what everything led to. And the end of the story was a document that pronounces anathemas, curses, on anyone who denies the Roman doctrine. But you know, the reality is, before the Council of Trent, there was always the possibility that Rome would have accepted the Reformation. Because there were cardinals of the Roman Church who were present at the Council of Trent who argued for something of a Lutheran view of justification. We don't hear that very much. But just think for a moment, if everything had been different, and if these cardinals had prevailed, and the Roman Church had adopted a Lutheran doctrine of justification by faith, while holding on to the Pope. That's confusing, isn't it? Now, it didn't happen, but it might have happened. Would, if they had accepted Luther's doctrine of justification, would participation in the Mass and submission to the Pope be acceptable? No, I don't think so. But that could have happened, you see. If we look at the Roman side of what's going on at the Reformation, and this is why Rome ultimately could not adopt Luther's doctrine of justification. If we look at the Roman side, there were two essential elements of identity to be Roman Catholic. Two things that ultimately they couldn't give up. The first of them is the Mass, the sacrifice of Christ by the priest, and all of the piety that was attached to the Mass. You know, it wasn't just that act of the priest standing before the people and taking a piece of bread and consecrating it and saying, "This is Christ's body." Or a cup of wine and saying, "This is Christ's blood." But there's a whole host of pious acts that are attached to the Mass. Feast days, for example, days that are given over to the celebration of various saints. Processions. When we were in Germany about 10 years ago, we stumbled upon a procession in the city of Mainz. It was the feast day of the Assumption of Anne, the name that they give to the mother of the Virgin Mary. And the cardinal and all of the bishops and all of the various orders of monks and priests and nuns and laymen process through the streets. It begins with the least important and it ends with the cardinal. And he walks under a canopy and he's holding in a box, it's called a monstrance, the host that has been consecrated, so that everybody can see the host as he walks down the street in the city of Mainz. That belongs to the Mass. You see, in Roman Catholic piety, it's much more than the Mass. And this had all developed during the Middle Ages, and it was essential to their doctrine. The other essential element to Rome was papal supremacy. You had to acknowledge the Pope. And he, you know, even in the Roman Church today, they don't like to admit this, but the Roman Church today is like Protestant Christianity. There's all kinds of different varieties. You have the Jesuits, and you have the Benedictines and the Augustinians and various orders, and they all have their differences and their peculiarities. But you know what holds them all together? The Pope. They all bow before the Pope. They all acknowledge the Pope. That's central. Prior to the Council of Trent, even justification by faith alone might have been possible if it could be made to fit into those categories, but it couldn't. And that's why ultimately the Council of Trent rejected in the strongest of terms the doctrine of justification by faith alone. And I think that that can be marked as the final ending of any hope for the Roman Church when they rejected the gospel in the way that they did. These two categories, the Mass and its piety and supremacy of the Pope, were at the very heart of the pressure to move ahead with reform. In the early Reformation movement, these people sometimes were called gospelers because they were not content to allow either of these things to continue. Look, if piety is all about outward actions, walking in a procession, keeping a feast day, venerating a saint, lighting a candle in the church, then religion simply is a matter of outward ritual. And the Reformers understood that religion, true religion, was a matter of faith. It was a matter of believing the words that God has spoken, that God has given to us, and living our lives based upon those words, not by outward acts. Remember we said yesterday or the day before that we only really have two outward acts. We have baptism and we have the supper, and that's all that we have. We don't have all the rest. And as Reformed Christians, we want to reject all the rest. You know, maybe you know there's been a movement lately among Protestant churches to go back to observing Lent. Even some good men have argued on their blogs on the internet that maybe Lent would be a good thing for us to do. And we ought to stand up and cry, no, 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 no. Never, never, never. Let's be satisfied with the simple worship that God has given to us. We know that these things are or can become idolatrous. Now, these things were at the struggle, at the heart of the things that led to the development of the English Reformation and English Puritanism. Because Henry produced a halfway house, and Puritanism comes after Henry, seeking to bring the Continental Reformation in all of its details to the Church of England. Of course, one of the things that they wanted was the system of church government that they saw in Geneva and in Switzerland, Presbyterianism, as over against the Episcopalianism of the Church of England and its system of bishops who have power within the church. The English Puritans faced all kinds of difficulties as they struggled to move forward, and those difficulties come because of the circumstances of the early Reformation under Henry VIII. Now, there's some more things that we can take note of that are really interesting. We use the word Reformation, don't we? And we know what we're talking about. When I say Reformation, you think Martin Luther, John Calvin, and a break with Rome. And you'd be right if you'd think those things. But what if I said the word reformations? What if I added an S to the end and suggested that maybe we ought to think in terms of reformations? That changes things just a little bit, doesn't it? Let me try to explain what I mean. And we have to make a distinction between the continent of Europe and England. There's a body of water between them, the English Channel, right? And until just maybe two decades ago, you had to take some kind of boat, a ship, across the channel to get from Europe to England. Nowadays, you can take a train and a tunnel that goes underneath. The first time that I was in that tunnel, a friend of mine said, let's go over to Belgium today or tomorrow. Okay, so we got in his car. We drove to the terminal. They loaded the car onto the train. We went under the tunnel, came up on the other side, got back in the car, and drove the rest of the way to Belgium. Pretty amazing that you can do that these days. You didn't have to take a boat. But back then, all there was water between them. And there were some differences between what went on in Europe and what went on in England. In Europe, in what we now call Germany or in Switzerland or in the Low Countries, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and in parts of France, the Reformation was largely local. It took place on a city by city or a region by region basis. You know, one of the problems that we have today is that we don't recognize that the modern situation is a very modern situation, and it didn't exist really before almost the beginning of the 20th century. What I mean is this. We talk about the nation of Germany, don't we? But it was really late in the 19th century that Germany as we know it came into existence. At the time of the Reformation, there was no Germany, but there were about 200 different local duchies, as we call them, little petty kingdoms in which one man would rule over his area. We talk today, you live in what county? What county are we in? Suffolk County, right? It's a city. It's a city and a county. Okay, Suffolk County is also the city, like New York City is also New York County. Okay, all right. Now, county comes from Europe, right? Mm-hmm. Who would be the big man in the county? The count, okay? That's where the word comes from. And we think of Count Dracula, right? Or somebody like that. But the count would be the petty king in the county. He would be the ruler. That would be his land. There were also places that are called duchies, D-U-C-H-Y. You know who's the big man in the duchy? The duke. Very good. It's the duke. That's a little bit higher than the count. The duchy might include some counties, but still, it's the count. In fact, you had this whole structure. The king ruled over the kingdom, and the kingdom was made up of these duchies who gave their allegiance to the king. They promised that they would help him if he would protect them. So they would join together and they would come. You had the king, you had the prince, and the prince's domain was called what? Prince of Wales is the lord of what? Wales, but what's it called? A principality. Okay? So you have the king over the kingdom, the prince over the principality, the duke over the duchy, and the count over the county. Now, okay, here's a really good question. In Europe today, there are still five duchies that have not joined up with any other countries. Who can name any?
San Marino.
San Marino, very good. That's a little blurb, a blot in the middle of Italy, northern Italy. San Marino never joined Italy. Italy is a result of a formation of a whole bunch of different counties and duchies early in the 20th century. Very good. You also said Monaco. Monaco's the most obvious one, right on the south coast of France, because of, what was her name, Princess, the actress, Grace, who married Prince Rainier, and there they were in Monaco. And of course, Monaco is a tiny little place that's known for two things, gambling and the Grand Prix. And maybe James Bond, you know, almost every James Bond movie goes to Monaco, right? Okay, so that's two. Very good. Liechtenstein, very good. That's number three, yep. Luxembourg's too big to be considered a duchy at this point, but that's a good try. Two more. One of them is not obvious. It's Vatican City, okay? But if you go to Rome and you go to the Vatican, when you cross the street into those porticos, you're in a different country at that moment. You don't need a passport to get there, but there you are. Okay, one more. It's between France and Spain. It's up in the Pyrenees Mountains. It's called the Andorra. That's the last one. But those are remnants of this ancient system that we had in Europe. You know, so we think of Germany, and we think of what we see on the map now that goes from the North Sea all the way down to Austria, and this massive area. But that's not really what Germany was at the time of the Reformation. It was a conglomeration of a lot of different places. So Luther, for example, in Wittenberg, was protected by Frederick the Wise because he was the ruler in that area, you see. But there were places in what was called Germany where Luther couldn't go because the ruler was sympathetic to Rome and would have wanted to have arrested Luther because of the benefits that it would bring to him if he put Luther under arrest, and ultimately Luther was put to death because of his actions, you see. The Reformation was local in these places, and it usually depended upon the big man, the powerful man, being sympathetic to the Reformation. That's true in Wittenberg, where Luther was. Saxony was the area that Frederick the Wise governed. Strasbourg, which is on the border of France and Germany. We were there last summer. Strasbourg has a history where sometimes it's in Germany and sometimes it's in France. Now it's in France, but the people, this woman who gave us a tour through a museum said, we really think of ourselves as Germans, even though it's in France. It moves back and forth. The Swiss states, Zurich or Basel or Bern or Geneva, these were not nations, but they were states. In Geneva, it was the city council that approved, and Zurich that approved of the Reformation. So you see, the Reformation in Europe tended to be local. It tended to come as a result of political power. People like Frederick the Wise, the Elector of Saxony, or the city councils with their armies in a place like Zurich. Do you remember how Zwingli died? He died on the battlefield. The great reformer of Zurich died fighting for leading an army for his own city. That's how we have to think of the Reformation in Europe. And it was largely directed, though it was local, though it was supported by the political office, the political power locally, it was directed principally by theologians, by men with connections to the church. And so I name the names Luther, Martin Luther, right? We think of him first and foremost as a great theologian, and certainly he was. If we think about Strasbourg, we think about Martin Bucer. Bucer is not a household name to us today in the way that Luther or Calvin would be, but Bucer is maybe more important than Calvin. When Calvin was forced to flee from Geneva for a couple of years, he went to Strasbourg, and Bucer became, in many ways, Calvin's mentor to prepare Calvin to go back and complete the Reformation in Geneva. Martin Bucer is a very important individual. We know the name of Zwingli and his followers in Zurich and all the rest. But we name these names and we identify these men because they were theologians. So you have local Reformation supported by the political power and directed by a well-known, well-equipped, trained theologian. Okay, that's the continent of Europe. You cross the channel and it's different. The Reformation in England is not local, it's national. Now, one of the reasons for that is simply that England has defined geographical boundaries that can't be moved. You know, one of the problems with the county, duchy, principality, kingdom situation is that boundaries on land can be moved pretty easily. And if Harry has a stronger army than I have and Harry invades, he changes the boundaries as he wants to do so. But when the sea is your boundary, there's not much you can do. Wales had lost its identity as a separate nation long before, and the Scots, I don't know if any of you are of Scottish descent, I'm not, so I can say this. The Scots were just wild men in the north. You know, you had Hadrian's Wall up there, and it wasn't a boundary really, but it did mark out the difference between Scotland, which had its own identity, and England below. And of course, there had been centuries and centuries and centuries of conflict between Scotland and England, right? Braveheart is the example, okay. England, though, had a well-defined national identity That's basically everything on the island south of Scotland. So it's not local. It's a king who has a defined geographic boundary. Likewise, the Reformation in England, because it's national, is something that's mandated by royalty. It was by the decree of Henry VIII that the Church of England rejected the Pope and moved in the direction of Reformation. It didn't come because, let me put it this way. Who's the great reformer of Wittenberg? Martin Luther. Who's the great reformer of Geneva? John Calvin. Who's the great reformer of Strasbourg? Martin Bucer. Okay, we're naming these names. Who's the great reformer of England? Somebody said Tyndale. Tyndale wasn't there, though. He had to flee because of persecution. Who was the great reformer of England? See, we don't come up with a name right away. Henry VIII, I just heard. In a sense, you see, there's a real sense where you can say that, even though it's doubtful the man was ever a believer. And that makes the situation in England really different, you see. Now, the right answer is Thomas Cranmer. Okay, that's actually the answer. But we don't recognize that because Cranmer doesn't have the stature of a Luther or a Calvin or a Zwingli or a Bucer. And maybe he shouldn't have that stature. But if you come to think who was the most important theologian ultimately who led forward the Reformation in England, it is Thomas Cranmer. But Henry VIII is a great answer, and that's right on target. So I won't disagree with you at that point. Thank you for doing that. That helped me. Another interesting facet of the Reformation in England is that it was directed principally by politicians. Okay? Now, if you're watching Wolf Hall, you know some of these names. Thomas Cardinal Wolsey. Wolsey is a fascinating character. And I quote him, I mention his name here. Somebody could rightly stand up at this moment and say, wait a minute, the Reformation never came in the lifetime of Wolsey. Why do you say him? And I say, you're right. In fact, my notes say Thomas Cardinal Wolsey only by implication and in the first stages. But Wolsey, though he was a cardinal of the Church of Rome, was really a politician. That's what he was. More than anything else, he was a politician. He was a political functionary. He was the Lord Chancellor of England. He was the Archbishop of York, which is the second most important ecclesiastical office in England. Archbishop of Canterbury is first. That's the first major province of the Church of England. York is the second major province of the Church of England. Wolsey was the Archbishop of York. In 1515, he was made a cardinal by the Roman Church, which gave him a higher status in the church than the Archbishop of Canterbury, who wasn't a cardinal. Okay, now think about how confusing that is. The Archbishop of Canterbury is the most important ecclesiastical officer in England. Okay, he's the top dog. But Rome makes the Archbishop of York a bigger dog by making him a cardinal. So you have effectively two competing positions here. You have the one who by tradition and by law is really the most important ecclesiastical official in England, and then you have the one who is made by Rome to hold an office in the universal church, who actually is higher than the Archbishop of Canterbury. So you have this confusing situation. Wolsey, though he made his way up the ladder of the church, was not a religious man at all, but he was a politician who understood how to use religion in order to manage and to meet his own goals. And he's the one that Henry turned to in the early stages. Now, if you've been watching Wolf Hall, Wolsey's on his deathbed in the last episode that I saw. Okay, so it's coming right at the very end of Wolsey's place. And the reason that Wolsey is sent away from Henry's court because Wolsey can't accomplish the purposes that Henry is seeking after, and Henry distances himself from Wolsey. It is thought that probably Wolsey was on his way to execution, but he died of natural causes. So he was never actually executed, but probably he was. But he's the first of the politicians who began the process of Reformation in England. The second one is the main character of the Wolf Hall series, and that's Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell followed Wolsey. He becomes, if you haven't read the book or you don't know the story, this is a spoiler. He becomes Henry's chief political advisor. And really, he becomes Henry's political henchman. He organized all kinds of things for Henry. Now, one of the interesting questions, and you see it in the Wolf Hall episodes, is that Cromwell, there's evidence at times to think that Cromwell might have been sympathetic to the doctrines of the Reformation. There are references along the way to Tyndale's Bible, to certain books of Luther that, if they're found in anyone's possession, will probably bring that person to death. And Cromwell, they give hints that Cromwell might have some of those books in his possession. It's an interesting question. We don't know. Did Cromwell read some Lutheran books? Did he get hold of an English translation of the Bible? Did he at all have sympathies with the Reformation? Fascinating question. No definitive answers to it, but there's a possibility of that. You have these politicians who are working for Henry and pulling the strings and manipulating circumstances to move forward the process of ultimately what was Reformation. Does that seem like the work of God? See, remember, rough and rough, vainglorious and arrogant. Henry had his own purposes, and he used whoever he wanted to use for the purpose of moving forward his own desires. Thomas Cromwell was executed in 1540. By the way, do you know what Wolf Hall was? Wolf Hall is the name of the Boleyn family residence, is where the name Wolf Hall comes from. Yeah, that was the name of the Boleyn family residence. Now, you see, when this paints an interesting picture of the Reformation in England, doesn't it? You see how different it is to what goes on in Europe. You have Martin Luther in Wittenberg in Saxony preaching and publishing and translating the Bible into German, and his works are going everywhere and people are reading them and listening to them, or listening to his sermons, or listening to the men that he's training in Wittenberg who are going out, and the Reformation spreads through the churches. The same is true in Geneva. Calvin has a ministerial college there in Geneva, and it was intended to train men to go into France and to bring the gospel to France. In fact, they had a sort of dark humor at graduation, because it was said that the diploma that they received from the academy in Geneva was the death certificate, because many of them knew that when they went back into France, they were facing martyrdom. And that diploma, in a sense, proved that some of them would lose their lives because they would go to preach the gospel. So that in those places, the gospel goes out from the church. But in England, the Reformation comes in from a wicked king. And it's because of circumstances in the life of that wicked king. It's very different from all of the rest of the reformations that go on in Europe. Now let's talk about Henry VIII. Henry VIII is one of the most famous and important kings in English history. Sometimes I ask the question, who's the most famous king in English history? And I get two answers. Who do you think? Henry VIII is one. Who do you think is the other? Arthur. King Arthur. Very good. That's all right. King Arthur. We don't even know if King Arthur existed. But Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table is the other one. You know, 2009 was the 500th anniversary of Henry's accession to the throne of England. And in 2009, I led a tour to England to Puritan and Baptist sites. We spent about 2 weeks over there. We landed in London at Heathrow Airport, and you know, you fly overnight, so you're exhausted, and you have to keep everybody awake the first day. And Hampton Court Palace is not very far away from Heathrow Airport, so we arranged to go to Hampton Court Palace. If you ever go to London and you get to visit any of the royal palaces, Hampton Court must be on your list. It's fantastic. It was built by Wolsey, Cardinal Wolsey, and taken away from him basically by Henry VIII. And Henry lived there. There's a Tudor part of the castle, and then there's a Carolingian part of the castle, and it's an interesting contrast between the two. But you really can, when you go to the Tudor section, you really get a sense of what life in 16th century England was like when Henry VIII lived. Any of you ever been to Hampton Court Palace? Well, you have to go. It's great. They also, for the kids, they have this fantastic maze. And you get in there and you can lose your kids for a couple of hours as they try to get out. And they're safe, of course, because they can't get out. You know where they are. They're somewhere in those green bushes. Of course, when we went, we had our daughter Susie with us. She made it out and we didn't. Mom and Dad, where are you? Oh, we're in here. Okay, go this way. Yeah, all right. It's a great place. But you know, when we came that day, we landed, we went through customs, we got on the bus, we drove just a few moments, we're over at Hampton Court, and it's the 500th anniversary. And there is an actor dressed up as Henry VIII, and there's a woman dressed up as Anne Boleyn, and there are other courtiers dressed up. The British realized that they could make a lot of money off of Henry VIII. He's so famous and so fascinating that even today, anything that has anything to do with Henry VIII is a real money-making machine for the Brits. So if you buy a house over there and you can prove that it's somehow related to Henry VIII, it's sort of like George Washington slept here, you know, but even bigger. You'll make a lot of money. He's really a fascinating character. Let me give you some simple facts about Henry's life. He was born June 28th, 1491. Okay, so that's 1 year before, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Okay, so that's a year before Columbus's voyage. He was about 9 years younger than Luther. Luther was about 9 years older than he was. He died January 28, 1547. He was 55 years old when he died. It has been suggested that when he died, he weighed as much as 450 pounds. He was a big man. He lived a life of luxury and indulgence. His father, Henry VII, was... to put it in simple terms, a very successful businessman. He was also a tyrant. But when he passed away, he left a great fortune to Henry VIII. And Henry VIII spent it all in luxury and ultimately ended up needing to do to find various ways to raise more money to take care of his country. He lived a life of luxury and indulgence, but also a life of great discomfort. January 24th, 1536, so he was, 44 years old. When he was a young man, he was apparently very athletic for his day. Huntsman, jousting, tournaments, and you wonder, as the prince, did they let him win or did he actually win? But he seems to have been quite an accomplished athlete. And so when he's 44 years old and he gets involved in a jousting tournament. And he's hit by a lance and is knocked off of his horse. Now they figure at this point that he weighed maybe 300 pounds. When he hit the ground, he went unconscious. And he was actually unconscious for 2 hours. For a while they thought he had died. When he awoke, from that point on, his life seems to change, and it has been suggested that perhaps he incurred a brain injury because he became a really terrible, aggressive tyrant after this fall off of the horse in the jousting tournament. I'm not saying he wasn't bad beforehand, but he got worse after this. It's also known that he sustained a serious wound to his leg. At the beginning of one of the episodes of Wolf Hall, they actually show Henry in a deathbed scene. And the camera pans over his leg, and you'll notice there's this huge open wound. I think it's on his left leg in the picture. And the voiceover says that the stench was so bad that no one could approach to him. That's what they say. Whatever this wound was, for 11 years, it was present on his leg. It never healed, and apparently it mortified and stank really badly. So you have this enormous man with a wound who's fallen off of a horse in a jousting tournament, who is king of England, who believes that it's his right, the divine right, that God has given him the right to rule over everything in his land. He's a tyrant in every way. And, you know, there's not a lot of romance, in a sense, to Henry VIII because he was a tyrant. Remember Edward Terrell's words, rough and rough. The rough, the vainglorious part is he's the king. And, you know, every picture you've ever seen of Henry, what's it look like? You know, he's standing there like this, decked out in all of his finery. So that's the vainglorious part. The arrogant part is off with his head. He's killing everybody, you see. He was crowned as king on June 24th, 1509, 4 days before his 18th birthday. And so he reigned over England for just under 38 years. For the first two decades of his reign, the first 20 years, he was a faithful Roman Catholic. And he even earned the title Defender of the Faith that was granted to him by Pope Leo X. The reason that he was given this title is that he wrote a treatise against Martin Luther. It was called The Defense of the Seven Sacraments. And the Pope was really pleased with it. Henry never liked Martin Luther. They never met. Luther despised Henry. And at least for a distance, they had a mutual loathing society. It's another one of these complicating factors in the Reformation as it comes to England. Now, one of the other, there's just all kinds of interesting things. I guess I'll stay with my notes and not jump ahead. I always have this tendency to do that. How many wives did Henry have? Do you remember? Six. And there's a rhyme that you can put, simple little rhyme, to tell you what happened to his wives. It goes like this. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. That's the ultimate fate of the six wives of Henry VIII. Divorced, Catherine of Aragon. Beheaded, Anne Boleyn. Died, Jane Seymour. Divorced, Anne of Cleves. Beheaded, Catherine Howard, the teenage girl. And then survived, the one who lived longer than he did, was his last wife, Catherine Parr. We'll talk about that probably tonight, some of those things. Now, these simple facts about Henry mask the complexities that are associated with Henry and the Reformation. And we need to talk about complexities. I guess that I only have about 4 minutes left, and maybe I'll stop here. Do we have any questions that you'd like to ask, or shall I just try to keep going for another few minutes?
I think jump ahead a couple minutes. We'll wait.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the complexities. Those are the simple facts, complexities. The first is the problem of the Tudor family, that's the family name, and their rule and their succession. Now, usually we think of the succession of the Tudor family after Henry. Why did he have six wives? Because he wanted a son. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but largely because he wanted a son. He wanted an heir. He wanted to create a dynasty, a Tudor dynasty that would last in perpetuity. And in order to do that, you have to have a son. But there's also a problem with Tudor rule before Henry. And that has to do with his father. And it does affect everything that happened later on. Henry's father, Henry VII, had a tenuous claim at best to the throne of England. because he won that throne on the battlefield. Let me put that another way. He seized power on the battlefield in 1485, just after Henry was born. No, just before Henry was born. And what Henry VII did was he eliminated his rivals by execution, one by one, up to 1419. So in a sense, Henry VII's right to reign was bathed in blood, complicated by the fact that there were other families who had better and stronger ancient claims to the throne than did the Tudors. The most famous of them were known as the Plantagenet family. They were descendants of the French and Norman kings of England, and their family line, their bloodline, was a much stronger bloodline and claim to the throne than did the Tudors. And they were very powerful. They owned great estates, they were wealthy, they were politically connected. The most important of those families is called the Poles, P-O-L-E-S. Margaret Pole, who was a cousin of Henry VIII, was ultimately executed by him. And her son Reginald became a cardinal in the Roman Catholic Church, and when Queen Mary came to the throne, became Archbishop of Canterbury. So they were a powerfully, politically connected family, both in state and in church. And Henry knew this. Our Henry knew this. You see, he comes to the throne and he holds power, but there are others who have a better claim to that power, and so he has to use his power to maintain his place on the throne. He was only the second monarch of the Tudor family, and he was well aware of the potential dispute that could be made against his family. And so much of what Henry VIII is trying to do is cement his position on the throne and also cement the position of his family in the future on the throne. Now, there's another problem that's related to this. And I'm going to stop there. I'll start tonight with the other problem that's related to Henry, because it is 10 of, and we probably should stop there. But please feel free to ask me questions. I hope already you see how interesting this is. You know, it would make a great, well, even, you know, a great mystery story or something. You know, there's all kinds of characters and plots and stuff that goes on. And, you know, sometimes church history is sanitized, isn't it? You know, we've triumphed. And then you look at it and you say, oh man, it's really a mess. But God triumphs over the mess. That's ultimately what we have to say. Well, let's pause here and we'll come to worship in 10 minutes or so.